This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. On today's Building Bridges,
we take a look at healthcare. Not a week goes by that we don't hear about cutbacks in healthcare benefits and of corporate downsizing due to healthcare costs. Bush's solution? Medical health savings accounts offer encouragement to employers to terminate employer-provided health benefits. But Representative Conyers' National Health Care Act is picking up support, as evidenced by the growing number of unions which are passing resolutions in support. This act ensures that every American, regardless of income, employment status, or race, has access to the highest quality and affordable health care services possible. And now, with us,
we have Karen Dolan from the Institute for Policy Studies, Don McCain with Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, and Paul Kachaha from Local 6787 of the United Steelworkers. And welcome to Building Bridges.
Let's begin, Will, for leaving on the back burner just for the moment, what about the uninsured? But what's wrong with the medical health savings accounts that President Bush placed so much stock in during his State of the Union address?
I think the question should be what's right about it. As they exist on their face, everything is wrong about it. If it's trying to address the problem that George Bush put forward in terms of covering more of our 46 million uninsured, I think he's got certainly the right problem. He reads the polls like everyone else does and knows that healthcare costs and having decent, affordable health coverage is number one priority for Americans. And this offering of what's essentially a tax shelter for wealthy Americans is a very cynical attempt to answer that problem.
The health savings accounts are really flawed policy from three perspectives. It's flawed tax policy, it's flawed health policy, and it's flawed pension policies. These accounts are kind of like IRAs, individual retirement accounts, with a special exemption for medical bills, so you can pay medical bills out of them, but otherwise you have to, they're much like a retirement account, but they're regressively funded. The tax system helps to fund the accounts for the wealthy, but not for lower income individuals, so it's terrible tax policy. Health policy, people who are sick deplete the funds very rapidly and then are dependent on a bare-bones policy that leaves them exposed and subject to bankruptcy, which is increasing because of medical bills. So it's terrible health policy. And finally, pension policy. Those who remain healthy get to use these in retirement, but those, ironically, who develop illnesses and have to use their accounts are penalized by having their pension taken away from them. And so it's terrible policy on all counts. I mean, that's a strikeout as far as
you got to have money to be able to save money to begin with. And people aren't saving a lot of money now. The country is going into debt. Personal debt has risen quite a bit to record numbers. 40% of those who save for the retirement with IRAs, it's wiped out in the first 10 years by a serious health illness. So, I mean, there is a big part of what the problem is with so-called medical savings plans. Yeah, they want you to save money for your retirement. They want you to save money for your health care. They want you to save money here and there, and then you end up losing it the first time you get sick.
And I would add a further detriment of these health savings accounts is that it's unprecedented in our tax code that not only are the deductibles and the payment on premiums under this proposition tax deductible, but also the withdrawal. So in this way, it's different from an IRA, because IRA are the withdrawals are taxed, and that's a source of revenue for our government, for our system. But under this, it's an encouragement to even shift, for wealthy individuals, money out of IRAs, out of their 401ks, and into health savings accounts, whereby they'll never be taxed. And that causes a huge drain down the road on revenues.
Paul, what just got you involved in the health care debate?
One of the main things that pushed us was the fact that the whole steel industry was collapsing and bankruptcies, and the steel companies were shedding all their what they call legacy costs. Those of us who've worked all our life are just a legacy, and those legacy costs were primarily health care benefits for retirees and our retirements. I lost half my retirement. A lot of people who were retired already lost all their health care coverage. And people had to then come up with $1,200 to $800 a month for insurance premiums under COBRA or higher, and that was almost all they were making on a retirement. So, you know, we saw that, you know, the only answer to this problem wasn't an individual company-by-company basis or state-by-state, so to speak, basis. We thought that this was a problem that needed to be addressed through the infrastructure of the country, which was the federal government had to do something. Just like if roads and bridges were falling down and roads were being destroyed, something has to be done with health care. It should be considered part of our national infrastructure. So we started to get locals to pass resolutions and to get central labor bodies to pass resolutions and try to get congressmen on board in on Conyers' bill of H.R. 676, which is improved and expanded Medicare for all. And the last 2 years, it's grown from start out about 30 congressmen co-sponsoring to just the other day, two more co-sponsored. We're up to about 65 at this point. We know it's a long-term struggle, but we see it as something that's going to eventually pay off.
Well, before we jump to what some of the recommendations are, let's look at what's driving health care costs up, and then the question of the uninsured, and kind of graduate also to some of the new Medicare proposals, which are driving people bonkers
and
trying
Medicaid.
To think, and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And so help us parse out those questions, and you can really pick any one of them to give us that broad information.
There is a problem with higher tech care, in fact, excess high tech care, that the studies of John Weinberg and his colleagues at Dartmouth have demonstrated that we waste a tremendous amount of resources on excessive high tech care, especially at the end of life, which has been demonstrated to be of actually inferior quality and impair health care outcome. That's one of the drivers, and of course, pharmaceuticals is part of this excess high-tech spending. Another problem is our administrative waste, and as the insurers are shifting more and more of the burden to the individual patient, then this administrative cost actually is magnifying compared to what the insurers are processing in the way of the distributing fund and health care. So we have a huge waste that is growing all the time.
Oh, I would add on, it's exactly right, what I think it was Don who was just speaking,
right,
that there's much higher administrative costs under this privatization scheme where you've got multiple private plans that are spending more money on marketing than on actual health care and medicine and trying to get you to buy their plans. And study after study has shown it's less efficient and more costly than were our medical health coverage being covered directly by Medicare itself. And so not only has the president's plan subsidized privatization of health care, but it's made it mandatory. So to get these tax incentives and to get these tax breaks, one, of course, needs to have these private high-deductible health plans, and also in order to get the benefits of the Medicare drug plan, which is a complete catastrophe, one has to be purchasing private health plans that are more expensive, less efficient, driving up costs. And on top of that, the law prohibits Medicare, that has the greatest bargaining power, prohibits Medicare itself from negotiating with the drug companies to lower the cost of the drug. So every way you look at it, the plan, by intentionally pushing public care into private companies, raises the cost.
Another important issue, I think, is what the increasing cost is not due to, and that is to not excessive overutilization by the patient by their choice. And yet this has been defined as the problem is they say, well, we need to have patients have more sensitivity to the financial costs, therefore let's shift the upfront costs, the deductibles and so forth, to the patient, and they'll spend the money more responsibly. That is utter nonsense. Most of our healthcare spending is by the 15 or 20% of people that use roughly 80% of healthcare. And this consumer-directed cost sensitivity doesn't play any role whatsoever in that 80% of healthcare spending. In the other 20%, it has a very minor role. So these consumer-directed things, the health savings accounts and so forth, are answers to an incorrect definition of the problem, and I think that's important to understand.
Karen, let's just back up for a second, because the system seems to be unraveling at an increasing rate, and part of that was the president's proposal last week with regard to Medicaid and the new proposals that came forth over the weekend with regard to Medicare. How does that affect people?
Well, that's right. There were, in addition to the president's proposals from the last budget, fiscal year 2006, which were passed by Congress last week, we have cuts already to Medicaid copayments. It's at least $16 billion over the next 10 years. And what you see is, cuts to the Medicaid program, which are increases in copayments, out-of-pocket expenses that already low-income and poor people are struggling to pay. You see increase in their premiums. There's reduction in benefits. It's a terrible blow to the folks who are very much in need of health care. And then on top of that, we've got in this new budget a proposal to cut even more money, this time from the Medicare program. So both programs that are designed to help our, not just our elderly, our disabled, and our poor, but increasingly affecting people who consider themselves anyway to be middle class. And as when you're talking about unraveling, it will spiral. I mean, I think it's beginning to spiral out of control when you put these health savings accounts into the mix, because that will eventually take the healthy and the wealthy out of the traditional risk pool that will again raise the premiums there. So there's almost no escape hatch, and I think it's very correct to say that it's unraveling. I think it's a huge danger that people need to look at. There's going to be a time in the very near future where even the most benevolent employer and well-meaning employer who wants to do the right thing and offer employer-based health coverage is not going to be able to afford it. The premiums are simply going to be too high, and the out-of-pocket cost for the average American will be too high, and those on the lower end of the spectrum are seeing cuts on top of cuts in unprecedented fashion. And what's been proposed by Bush is in no means a solution. In fact, it just exacerbates the problem.
One of the things that I've heard the Bush administration say is that certainly in terms of the Medicare, all the different plans really only boil down to four or five when somebody with some consciousness and knowledge explains it to people, and then it's about choice.
Well, that's more that's simply more smoke and mirrors. Ask the millions of seniors who have already complained in 24 different states that have had to pick up the cost for these seniors who are now going without medications that they were receiving for free a couple of months ago, that are not able to enroll in plans because there's simply too many, that it's too confusing. They offer different benefits, different co-payments. They cover different drugs. Even the literature that the Medicare program put out in the fall contained errors in it. There's complaints that no one can be reached at the hotlines, that pharmacies, the pharmacists in the pharmacies are unable to get answers, are unable to figure out what's covered and what isn't. We see reports today that in the Washington Post was reports of mental health patients going without their medications in a way that's seriously detrimental to their health. And we've seen the biggest debacle one could have imagined that was people tried to predict what would happen when this came into play, but I think it's been even a worse disaster than people had thought it was. So again, those are nice words from President Bush, but we've got to get to the truth behind those fancy words.
What are we saying about ourselves as a country if we make it harder for people to get something that is so necessary, like health care? I mean, we haven't even mentioned how Bush has cut the veterans' benefits even. At a time when people are in war, their medical benefits were cut for a lot
of
veterans.
There's more proposals to cut veterans' medical benefits in this new budget as well.
Are we being too critical? Isn't this just some of the quirks that come along with a new prescription program?
Who are you? My co-host?
These are the kind of rationalizations. Let it play out. We will iron out some of the kinks that will become rationalized, and we will pursue it. And again,
yeah, also said that the premiums are lower than they thought they were going to be.
Right.
Yeah, and as it pays out, as this all plays out, it's going to add about $500 trillion to the federal budget over the next decade. So even if it were possible for these so-called kinks that are more like the, you know, Grand Canyon, it was possible for those to be paved over, we're still looking at an enormous addition to the federal budget deficit, which that just will cause this circular motion in terms of then again cutting the budget and cutting the budget. This is no way out.
And there's a lot of waste built in that extra budget. It's because of all the private capital gains that are being made by those who are in the pharmaceutical industry and overall in the whole medical industry.
How does that play out?
Well, the cost of drugs are not being cut for the extent to which they really are in terms of the cost of what they make to produce them. I mean, when you can have some drugstores that can sell drugs for a lot less than other drugstores, somebody is still making a lot of money, whether it's the drug store industry or with the drug industry itself.
And it won't drive prices down at some point if this ensues? I mean, the Veterans Administration is able, Veterans Hospitals purchase drugs in a certain way, and the drugs are considerably lower. Doesn't this kind of supply and demand, to some extent, wind up rationalizing the price of drugs? And if not, why?
Well, no, the Veterans Administration isn't working on a supply and demand. They're able to negotiate down the drugs through bulk buying, through the government negotiation power, which is prohibited under this Medicare drug plan. So the Veterans Administration can bargain down to 50% less than the charges of people that are enrolled in the Medicare drug plan. So once you have, when you have a single-payer health provider, that's when you can negotiate down the prices, and that's where the prices are lower, not under supply and demand.
Right, because with all the different players involved in this, some people are paying more money for a drug than their neighbor would be paying for the same drug. It all depends on your mix of drugs, and that's part of what is so confusing about this for the people who are trying to pick their provider, so to speak, is what for their mix of drugs. And some people, you know, they take a lot of different drugs depending on what their condition is, and not everybody has all those drugs at a cheap rate. So that's part of the confusion, and also part of where the hidden costs come in and the benefits to those drug companies who are supplying those drugs.
Paul, the labor movement has sat by for over a generation while this unraveling has occurred, and your local was one of the first ones, the first of many actually, in Central Labor Councils to bring forth resolutions for single payer, for the Conyers bill. Are people starting to at long last speak out in the labor movement?
Yes, I think, you know, it's gotten to the point where since, you know, labor is representing not just those who are organized, but those who aren't organized benefit by those things that labor fights for. You know, we're seeing ourselves once again as a movement that needs to make some changes socially in our country along the lines of things like health care. The labor movement isn't speaking with one voice on that yet, but I think that the labor movement, from evidence of what we're seeing in support growing for a national health care system, I think a consensus isn't too far away.
Well, effectively, certainly Representative Conyers has raised issues in a way that really speak to the universality and a universal health system, in the form of a single-payer health system. I'm not sure everybody knows what that is, but why haven't the Democrats, who certainly learned going back to Clinton and forward that the number one agenda, domestic agenda, is health care, why haven't they moved in for an aggressive critique of what is being proposed by Bush and real advocacy of universal health care, or certainly the Conyers bill?
Well, I think you are seeing a critique of the Bush proposal. I really don't think we're going to see a major legislation regarding health savings accounts, because the policy wonks are getting the word out and people are understanding how detrimental this is. On the other hand, the Clinton failure to achieve a universal health care system set Washington back, and the decision was made that any reform would have to be incremental. And whenever you bring up the topic of universal health care coverage, single payer, that's always the response. Well, yes, that's what everyone wants, and that's what we're aiming for, but we can't do it. It's not feasible, so we're stuck with the incremental approaches. Well, you know, that is changing. January 31st, Senator Kennedy introduced his Medicare for All bill, and it's incremental steps because it brings in children, adults 55 to 65, and then eventually everyone into a Medicare for All program. So we really are back again thinking about a universal health care system. And, of course, those of us who are single-payer advocates are saying, here's the right one. This is the one that will work for everyone. Comprehensive, affordable, high-quality care for absolutely everyone. And they know that. And even the conservatives understand the issues. That when the conservatives bring it up, they always say, well, you know, what we don't want is a single-payer system. They say it every time someone discusses comprehensive reform. That means it's back on the national dialogue.
So when some people say universal health care, I mean, the Clinton bill was universal health care, but it just died under its own weight. Are we talking about the Conyers bill as something different?
Very different. Yeah. It's a single-payer bill. It's a government-run, government-financed, taxpayer-financed, single health insurance system. You have none of the private insurer like the Clinton plan had.
Right.
They came up with this competitive model of various insurers competing with each other, and it was a very complex and administratively wasteful system, so it didn't solve a lot of the problems that we have. But with a single system, it's if we took Medicare, fixed it so it works much better, and then gave that to everyone in the nation, we can provide truly comprehensive, high-quality care for absolutely everyone without spending one more penny than we're spending now. That's the big difference between Conyers' proposal and the other models of using private health plans.
Well, you've helped us understand a great deal, but this must be an issue that certainly this station and this program takes up on a more consistent basis, and that is the struggle for a universal, affordable health care system for everyone in this country.
And we've been speaking with Don McCain, Physicians for a National Health Care Program, Paul Kachaha with Local 6787 of United Steelworkers, and Karen Dolan, Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you much.
And for Building Bridges, thank you for listening. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And we go out with a song about that corporate Goliath, Walmart, an employer who refuses to give decent health care to its workers. Garth Brooks has signed on to be a spokesperson for Walmart, but what if he were to change sides to champion Walmart workers? Let's listen.
It was summer '05 when Walmart and I signed the biggest deal of the year. They gave me a pin and a smiley face grin and said, Garth, boy, you'll love it here. But I had my doubts, so I went to find out what's hidden behind Walmart's smirk. I opened that door, my jaw hit the floor. That's one f***ed up place to work. Now I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. Don't get caught bitching.
Hey!
Their healthcare plan fits on two pages, so they're sick and tired and contagious. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. Now, one thing I've learned, when a Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights, stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. 'Cause the union's missing. It's time for us to be courageous and stop these union busting outrages. 'Cause I don't need any more friends with low wages.